From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we continue to celebrate our 20th anniversary as a national daily show by featuring excerpts from our first year on the air. Oliver Sacks is a physician who chronicles case histories of the offbeat. Back in 1987, he came on Fresh Air to discuss his book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Sacks also is known for his book, Awakenings, which was made into a hit film starring Robin Williams and Robert De Niro. Also, we'll listen back to an interview with best-selling author Tom Wolfe. He's known for his books The Right Stuff, Bonfire of the Vanities, and The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. Jazz guitarist Marty Gross plays a couple of Fats Waller tunes, and we'll hear from the late musician Larry Adler, who made a name for himself as the world's greatest harmonica player. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. This month marks the 20th anniversary of Fresh Air's national daily broadcast, and we're celebrating by replaying some of the interviews from that first year. Our first guest is neurologist Oliver Sacks. He's still best known for his best-selling collection of case histories, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Dr. Sacks has described himself as a reporter of the human condition in extremis. His patients have severe neurological disorders, such as aphasia, Parkinson's disease, and Tourette's syndrome, disorders that have deprived them of memory, movement, cognition, or sensation. In all, Sacks has written 9 books and is a regular contributor to The New Yorker. This interview is from October 1987.
Dr. Oliver Sacks, welcome to Fresh Air.
Nice to be here.
Before we talk about the medical and spiritual implications of the work that you do, I'm going to ask you to tell the story of the man who mistook his wife for a hat, one of the case studies that you've written about. This was a music teacher and singer who didn't recognize that he had a disorder. What were the symptoms that he was showing?
Well, the first problem was that he had difficulty recognizing his students at the music academy. As soon as they spoke, he recognized them at once, but he couldn't recognize them visually. And soon he couldn't recognize anyone or anything visually. He couldn't recognize his wife. He couldn't recognize himself. He couldn't recognize common objects. He saw them perfectly clearly, but what he saw carried no meaning for him and no sense. And this prompted him to sort of ingenious but sometimes wild and sometimes absurd guesses as to what he might be seeing.
And you titled the case study The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat because in reaching for his hat, he reached for his wife's head by mistake.
When I saw him in the first interview, he was obviously not demented, but a delightful, intelligent, civilized man with a sense of humor. He kept encountering the fact that he made mistakes, but he didn't recognize what the problem was. And it mixed with all his intactness. There was a succession of absurd mistakes. At one point, he confused his left foot with his shoe, and he didn't seem to know which was which. And then right at the end, when he went to reach for his hat, he got his wife's head instead.
What is the condition that he had?
Well, this is called a visual agnosia. And what happens is that the normal meeting between visual input, between images and a person's memories and ideas and feelings and expectations doesn't occur. And so, this goes with a problem in the visual association areas at the back of the brain. And so he sort of had raw vision, a sort of raw seeing, which didn't ascend into the realm of meaning.
Although he couldn't make sense of what he saw, he was a musician and singer, and he still had perfect musical sense. And your prescription to him was music. Why?
He was really absolutely lost in this meaningless, shattered visual world. And he desperately needed some way of organizing himself. Now, I think all of us tend to either use internal speech or internal music to organize ourselves to some extent. I mean, one has things like nursery rhymes, 1, 2, buckle my shoe, or marching songs or work songs. But the song, as a unit of organization, became tremendously important and crucial for this man, who was so totally lost visually, couldn't use any visual organization, but in fact was a marvelous musician and singer, and a man who sort of generated songs all the while. And one saw again and again that he couldn't dress, he couldn't shave, he couldn't eat, unless he really set the activity to music internally. On one occasion when he was eating, there was an interruption, there was a sudden, the postman suddenly knocked at the door, and this completely shattered the activity, and he looked quite bewildered for a few seconds until he was able to recapture the melody of eating.
You know, your prescription of music reminds me of something that your friend, the poet W.H. Auden, had said to you, which is that, he spoke of the poetic and religious states of affliction. And I wonder what you think, how that applies to your work, the poetic and religious states of affliction.
I thought you were going to actually quote one of Auden's favourite quotations from Novalis, where Novalis says, every disease is a musical problem, and every cure is a musical solution. And certainly with Dr. P, as with many of my Parkinsonian patients, people sometimes who can't move unless they sing or dance. You know, one sees absolutely they've been unmusicked by disease and can be remusicked back into health. I think that the poetic and the religious are almost sometimes an integral part of patients' perceptions as to what may be happening with them. Something I describe in the Hat book and also at more length in an earlier book, A Leg to Stand On, as a patient whom I saw as a student who had apparently lost his left leg. He was found on the floor, very bewildered. He'd apparently thrown himself out of bed in a peculiar way. And the story he gave was that he had woken up from sleep. He had found that there was a foreign leg in the bed with him. Disgusting object. He threw it out. And then, and now horribly, he had come out with it, and now it was attached to him. And I said, but it's your leg? And he said, you know, shouldn't I know my own leg? And I said, yes, you should. And he said, well, I know it's not my leg. Now, this thing for him was not only was terribly wrong. It felt ugly. It felt hateful. It felt obscene. It felt unholy. It felt an offence against nature. The particular physiology in his case was that he had a tumour in the opposite side of the brain, which had expanded while he slept, and had blotted out the part of the brain which represents the leg. So the leg image had been obliterated. Therefore, he could not recognise his leg as his own. Therefore, it seemed absolutely other. But the absolutely other always seems uncanny and horrible and obscene and unholy and God-forsaken. And words like this or concepts like this will be used by every patient, irrespective of background, of intelligence, of education. The alienation is almost intrinsically in the area of subjectivity is sort of felt as anti-poetic, anti-religious. And by the same token, when it comes back, there's the feeling, to quote Dante, of the holy and glorious flesh restored. And so I think even at this level, sort of the body in health is always felt as sort of as beautiful and holy, although one may not appreciate this unless it's taken away and one suddenly deals with a radically depreciated world.
Your way of writing case studies is really very literary. It's not empirical. It's not cut and dry. You're really describing states of mind as well as neurological conditions. And I've wondered if patients talk to you that way, if they are as descriptive as you are in telling their stories.
I think, obviously, this will depend on the condition and the patients, but above all, I think on the situation, in that if a patient is not permitted implicitly or explicitly to talk about himself, if he's reduced, if he's given a sort of catechism, do you have this, do you have that, then he will reduce himself to a list of symptoms. He won't say what it's actually like. He won't depict the world he is in, which he's been thrust into. But I think that if patients have a complaint, sometimes more serious or as serious as their primary complaint is that they can't communicate what it's like. And I think that a major act of the doctor is somehow to, De Quincey once talked about the pressure of the incommunicable upon the heart, is to let the patient try and communicate, and the doctor must sort of help him, must reach out to delicately to assist this trembling communication. And so that between them, the way it is, the world of illness, can come into being.
You've done a lot of your work on backwards of hospitals, charity hospitals, asylums. Why have you gone there looking for the kinds of cases you are interested in studying?
Well, it was really not quite in that order. I was there in places which most of my colleagues wouldn't be seen dead in, and which no ambitious young doctor would go to, and which are felt to be the sticks. But in fact, here there is the priceless gift of leisure. There's no pressure to diagnose. There's no pressure to do anything. Also, you can encounter a complete world. I mean, these places are really little worlds. And I think that an unpressed exploration of getting deeper and deeper is possible in such places. It's hardly possible in any other places.
There's no pressure because they're considered hopeless anyways?
Partly. This was well realized by the founders of neurology, by Hewlings, Jackson and Charcot in the last century. They spent much of their lives in chronic hospitals, institutions, asylums. But now doctors don't. But certainly with the patients I describe in Awakenings, these people who had been in hospital for 40 years or more since the great sleeping sickness epidemic, I had no idea that such patients existed, that such lives existed, until I went into a chronic hospital.
Has that happened other times, too, that you've found disorders that have not really been described before?
Well, certainly they haven't been described with the richness and the fullness which they should have. In general, I think description has become sort of obsolete.
You've described it as almost a 19th century art in medicine.
Yeah. I love 19th century medicine and science. It may have been so short in a way on certain empirical remedies and even relatively short on physiological concepts and, of course, very short on technology. But the respect for the patient and for the detail of what was happening to them, I think, could often generate almost novelistically rich and at the same time sort of medically and scientifically accurate descriptions. So much so now that there's major discoveries have been made by going back over 19th century descriptions. Now we can see what went on. I think most of the descriptions now are so meagre, so threadbare, and also so they're too quick to diagnose, to pin labels on.
When you're working with patients who have been almost abandoned by the medical profession, it's just a kind of caretaking type of thing, are you able to do anything to really change their condition, or are you more interested in observing them? And let's leave out the sleeping sickness patients, because you were able to administer a new drug there that totally changed their condition. But in other cases where there isn't a drug that's going to change their state, what can you do?
My first notion is to try and understand with the patient what's going on. Now, from the understanding, treatment may come. So that, for example, with one case I describe in the Hat Book, as I call it for short, as a Parkinsonian man who leant grossly to one side, although he wasn't aware of this. He was surprised that people commented. I took a videotape of this, I played it back to him. And it was only when he saw this that he realized what was happening, and he then asked a very acute question. He said he wondered whether there were balancing mechanisms. He used to be a carpenter, like spirit levels, like bubble levels, in the head, which had been impaired by his disease. And I said, yeah, exactly. And he then thought again, and he wondered if one couldn't make such little levels outside the head, for example, attached to by a nose clip to the glasses, and whether this would serve to balance him. And I said, it's a wonderful idea, let's try it. And in fact, it worked beautifully. Now, here is a man who, all I did, in a sense, was to...
Give him a metaphor.
yes, I, did, right? or he gave himself a metaphor. No, I assisted his understanding and indeed his movement to a cure. I mean, I love this sort of collaboration. When it's possible.
I thank you very much for talking with us about your work. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Oliver Sacks speaking with Terry Gross in 1987. Coming up, some Fats Waller tunes by Marty Gross as our retrospective continues. This is Fresh Air. This month, we're celebrating 20 years of Fresh Air as a national daily broadcast by listening back to excerpts from our first year. Marty Gross is one of a handful of musicians who specializes in jazz rhythm guitar, played on a hollow-bodied instrument. He specializes in tunes from the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. In 1987, we invited him to our studios to play a couple of songs written by one of his big inspirations, Fats Waller.
Mischief now, really am in love and how I'm through playing with fire. It's you whom I desire. All the world can plainly see you're the only one for me. I've told them all in advance, they can't break up our romance. No living up to every vow, I'm keeping out of mischief now, fire. It's you whom I desire. All the world can plainly see you're the only one for me, babe. I have told them all in advance, they can't break up our romance. No living up to every vow, I'm keeping out of mischief now, babe. I'm keeping out of mischief now, fat mama. I'm keeping out of mischief now. That was Keeping Out of Mischief by Thomas Fats Waller. His exuberance and his love of life and his composing talents come to life in a song like this next one called I'm Crazy About My Baby. It goes something like this.
I'm walking on air, 'cause I've left all my blue days behind. I've learned how to care, 'cause there's love, really love, on my mind. I'm the world's most happy creature. Tell me, what can worry be? I'm crazy about my baby. My baby's crazy about me. Cupid was the teacher, he and I agree. I'm crazy about my baby. My baby's crazy about me. Parson, get that book out, ready in your hand. Keep a lookout, you can understand. We're an A1 combination, a perfect he and she. I'm crazy about my baby. My baby's crazy about me. Da di da 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 di do 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 do. My baby's crazy about me. Dance with the puzzle. I'm a superhero. My baby's crazy about me. Oh, ding dong, ding dong, tingling, 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 bring long, ding dong. wedding bells for baby and me. Zaddy, daddy, daddy, do, 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 zappa, tappa, tappa, Gilbert Sullivan, I was so very serious by when I polish up the handles on the big brass door. My baby's crazy about me. Creature, what can worry be? I'm crazy about my baby. My baby's crazy about me. Cupid was the teacher. He and I agree. I'm crazy about my baby. My baby's crazy about me. Oh, Parson, get that book out. Steady in your hand. Keep a lookout, you can understand. We're an A1 combination of perfect. He and she, I'm crazy about my baby. My baby's crazy about me. My baby's crazy about me.
Guitarist Marty Gross, performing in the Fresh Air Studios in 1987. His latest CDs are Marty Gross and His Hot Combination and Chasin' the Spots. We'll continue with our 20th anniversary celebration in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation. During National Foster Care Month, promoting lifelong family connections for all kids in foster care at aecf.org. From Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. And from Fox Searchlight, presenting Waitress, an uplifting comedy by Adrienne Shelley about a small-town girl with big dreams, in select theaters May 11th. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Master of the Mouth Organ. We hear from the late Larry Adler. He turned the harmonica into a jazz and classical instrument back in the early part of the 20th century. And best-selling author Tom Wolfe tells us why he always wears a white suit. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. Even though new journalism is old now, Tom Wolfe is still celebrated for pioneering the style. New journalism used the techniques of fiction, descriptive scene settings, dramatic tension, and dialogue. In that new and flamboyant style, Wolfe wrote about Ken Kesey's LSD experiments in the book Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. His essay, Radical Chic, mocked white liberals eating fancy hors d'oeuvres at a fundraising party for the Black Panthers. Wolfe probed the space program in The Right Stuff and the excesses of the 1980s in Bonfire of the Vanities, his first novel. Terry interviewed him in 1987 when Bonfire of the Vanities was published. She started by asking him about new journalism.
You started to use the techniques of fiction to write journalistic stories. What were you reacting against in the style of journalism?
There was a neutral, so-called objective voice that journalists were expected to assume at that time. And now we're getting back to the late 50s and the early 60s. And I frankly found it absolutely boring. I also, having had it in the back of my mind that I was, you know, at some point I was going to quit journalism and write fiction. I mean, that's what everyone interested in writing starts into journalism with. That's the idea. I began to be intrigued with the notion of, well, here I am a journalist, well, why not use, if it's possible, some of these techniques that short story writers and novelists use while doing nonfiction. And this became a great game and a great experiment, and pretty soon, by the mid-60s, seemed to me much more important than writing fiction. I mean, there was nothing going on in fiction that even remotely compared in excitement with what was going on in what at that time was called the new journalism.
Was it a sudden thing that got you to write that way? Did you suddenly say, well, I can't write this piece in the old style, I've got to write it in this new style, the old style just won't work? Or did your writing gradually evolve?
No, well, I did have a kind of a involuntary epiphanal moment in, let's see, what year was it? It was 1963, it must have been. There was a, late in 62, a newspaper strike began. I was by now working for the New York Herald Tribune, and I suddenly found myself out of a job, and I needed to make some money, so I went over to Esquire magazine and sold them on the idea of a story on customized cars, which at that time were being made in very fanciful forms by teenagers in Los Angeles, the era of Big Daddy Ed Roth and George Barris and so on. So they said, okay, go on out to California and do this story. I remember checking into the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, and over the course of 4 weeks running up this enormous bill, I came back to New York, found myself utterly blocked. I could not write this story. I went to the managing editor of Esquire, Byron Dobell, who's now editor of American Heritage, and I told him, I said, Byron, I'm sorry, I just simply cannot write this story. I just have to drop the assignment. He says, you can't do that. We've got about $10,000 worth of color plates of these ridiculous automobiles you're supposed to be writing about on the already made. We can't do anything about that. So why don't you just give us your notes, and we'll get some competent writer to put them together. So with a very heavy heart one night, as a matter of fact, it must have been after 9 o'clock at one night, I started typing up these notes in the form of a memo which began, Dear Byron, the first place I saw customized cars was at a teen fair in North Hollywood, California, as straight as I could do it, but as fast as I could do it to get this humiliating task over with. And I ended up typing at top speed for about 8 or 9 hours. And in that time, I produced 50 typewritten pages. I took this over to Esquire, turned it in about 9 o'clock in the morning, went home to sleep, and I got a call about 4 that afternoon from Byron Dobell saying, well, Tom, we're going to knock the Dear Byron off the top of your memo and run the memo as the article. And that article became the one entitled The Candy-Colored Tangerine Flake Streamlined Baby, which was the title of my first book. What had happened was, in writing what I thought was a memorandum to a single individual who was about my own age, Byron Dobell, that I had somehow liberated myself from all of the fears and all of the constraints that you feel when you are going to write something as formal as a magazine article for a national audience. I'd reached that kind of tone that a lot of people are able to reach in writing a letter to a friend. There are many great writers of letters who freeze when they are told to write a course paper. Or,
you sure? Well, a lot of people tell you, write it as if you're telling your friend about it. Of course, easier said than done.
Well,
it implies that you're more articulate somehow when you're talking to a friend about it, which isn't, of course, necessarily
not
true.
Not necessarily true, but you are freer, and it'll work the first time for anybody.
Well, that that article established a new style for you, which you've been building on for a long time. Now, that style has created real reverberations within journalism. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk to you a little bit about the legacy of that style. It seems that it spawned a lot of terrific writing, and it spawned a lot of bad writing, too. I don't know if you feel that way. Do you? that there are a lot of excesses that have been...
It can lead to excesses, particularly in the form of purple prose.
Yeah.
It's a very demanding form, and I think a lot of people who try it don't realize how much reporting you have to do first. Without the information behind it, all of these techniques, which are things like scene-by-scene construction and use of extended passages of dialogue and point of view in the Henry James sense, without the facts, which can only be obtained through reporting, it can really fall flat. It just becomes a verbose technique.
Tom Wolfe speaking to Terry Gross in 1987. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1987 interview with Tom Wolfe after his first novel, Bonfire of the Vanities, had been published.
Can I ask you the dread questions about your white suits?
Yeah, now we're getting serious. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, let's get down to real business here. Signature as far as your wardrobe goes has always been the three-piece suit, tailor-made, usually white. Now, something I've always wondered about wearing a white suit is that you really have to protect yourself because anything is going to get you dirty. And as a journalist, it seems to me you really want to dive into a situation and do what needs to be done. But if you're wearing all white, you have to keep everything at a certain distance.
Well, two things that come to mind when you ask about that. One is, I have discovered that for me, you know, maybe it doesn't work for everybody, for me, it is much more effective to arrive in any situation as a man from Mars than to try to fit in. I've tried, when I first started out in journalism, in magazine work particularly, I used to try to fit in. I remember doing a thing on stock car racing. I went down to North Wilkesboro, North Carolina, to do a story on a stock car racer named Junior Johnson. And I tried to fit into the stock car scene. I wore a green tweed suit and a blue button-down shirt and a black knit tie and some brown suede shoes and a brown Borsellino hat. And I figured that was really casual, really the stock car races. And after about 5 days, Junior Johnson, whom I was writing about, came to me and says, "I don't mean to be rude or anything," he says, "but people I've known all my life down here in Ingle Hollow," that was where he came from, "say, they keep asking me, Junior, who is that little green man following you around?" It was then it had dawned on me that, A, nobody for 50 miles in any direction was wearing a suit of any color, or a tie for that matter, or a hat. And the less said about brown suede shoes, the better, I can assure you. So I wasn't fitting in to start with. I was also depriving myself of the ability to ask some very obvious questions if I thought I fit in. I was dying to know what an overhead cam was. People were always talking about overhead cams, but if you're pretending to fit in, you can't ask these obvious questions. After that, I gave it up. I would turn up always in a suit, and many times a white suit, and just be the village information gatherer. And you'll be amazed if you're willing to strike that role.
When you were doing the research for your book, Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, which is about Ken Kesey and the psychedelic acid trips, were you dressed like that too?
Oh, yes. And it would have been, actually, to have tried to fit into that scene would have been fatal, perhaps literally fatal. Kesey had this this abiding distaste for pseudo-hippies or hipster. There was really no such term at that time, but well, let's call them pseudo-hipsters. You know, the journalist or lawyer or teacher who on the weekends puts on his jeans and smokes a little dope and plays some Coltrane records and tries to be part of the scene. And so he had a device called Testing People's Cool. And I remember once witnessing this. It was on one of these weekends. And he said, all right, let's everybody get naked. That was his word for naked. And get on our bikes and go up Route 1. This was in California. And they did. They took off all their clothes. They got on their motorcycles. And they started riding up Route 1. Now, this separated the hippies from the weekend hipsters, if you will, very rapidly. But now I didn't have to worry because I wasn't. I was in my my three-piece suit with a big blue corduroy necktie, and the idea that I was going to take any of this off for anybody was crazy. So you know, I was safe.
You probably just look like another freak to a lot of freaks.
Well, after about 2 weeks, one of the Ken Kesey's group, the Pranksters, named Doris DeLay, said to me, you know, you got on the weirdest outfit around here. And it was the most unusual in that particular little corner of the woods.
Would you ever let a journalist observe you, hang out with you? I don't mean just interview you and write a piece about you. Maybe this has happened already. But say a journalist wanted to almost move in with you for a few weeks, really get a sense of your life, follow you around on a story you were writing. Would you let anyone do that?
Probably not. I don't. I've never felt that anybody owes me the courtesy or favor of letting me observe them, or that nobody has any obligation to answer my questions. And by the same token, I don't feel I have the obligation to answer anybody else's if I don't. Want to. I don't think it's an inalienable right of the American press to be cooperated with. You know, most people, if they let the press observe them, are striking an implicit bargain. They feel that they know that there's something in it for the press, and they feel that there's something in it for themselves. And I think we might as well be frank about it. It is some kind of bargain. Not that the outcome is going to be, the outcome of what is written should be a certain thing, but that, okay, I'll give you this freedom of observation in hopes that I'm going to get this particular. I think that's the way it works out.
Well, that leads me to my final question, which is some people probably who got written about by you felt burned afterwards, thinking specifically of the Radical Chic piece that you wrote about a fundraising party for the Black Panthers at Leonard Bernstein's house.
Yes,
and, I'm sure he was sorry that you were there.
Yes, I think he was. I think you have to take, as the journalist, you have to take the position that what you are doing is important. That the process of discovery that you are going through is as important, if not more important, than any issue that is involved in the story that you're writing. In looking back at the story on Leonard Bernstein and the Black Panthers, the story Radical Chic, I think it was important to see exactly how the phenomenon that I called Radical Chic worked. What it was all about. And I think you can't afford to be constantly wringing your hands over the impact of what you're doing, whether you're talking about the impact on the individuals that you're writing about or the impact on the issues that are involved, in this case, support for radical groups in the late 1960s. I was heavily criticized after that for drying up fundraising, which I don't think I did, but drying up fundraising for these radical groups among wealthy people, among socialites in New York. Well, whether I did or I didn't, I don't think you can worry about that. I think if you start worrying about that, you're no longer writing, you're involved in public relations.
Tom Wolfe, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your ideas with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Tom Wolfe, speaking to Terry Gross in 1987. His latest novel is called I Am Charlotte Simmons. Coming up, one more vintage interview with the late harmonica virtuoso Larry Adler. This is Fresh Air. Concluding today's celebration of 20 years of Fresh Air as a national daily show, we have one more interview to replay from our first year. The late Larry Adler was the world's foremost harmonica virtuoso. He began his musical career in vaudeville and went on to play with such musicians and performers as George Gershwin, Fred Astaire, Jack Benny, and Duke Ellington. But Adler also was at home in the concert hall, performing Beethoven as well and as passionately as he performed pop and show tunes. Larry Adler died in 2001. When Terry spoke with him in 1987, he had just published his autobiography, It Ain't Necessarily So. Let's start with what Terry had to say about him.
It's been said of Adler's musicianship that what he can't do on the harmonica can't be done. And Adler has said of his own work that he would like his epitaph to repeat what Billie Holiday once said to him, "You don't play that thing, you sing it." Larry Adler, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. I'm very ashamed of you. I may as well start off telling you right
now. What did I do?
Oh, you cleaned up the Billie Holiday story.
No, I know. I took out the expletive.
Yeah, well, you know, why can't we tell it this way? She heard me play with Duke Ellington, and then Duke took me over, and he said, "Larry, this is Billie Holiday." And I put out my hand to say, "How do you do?" And she says, "Man, you don't play that bleeping thing. You sing it." Now, you see, you can get it that way.
The way you tell it in your autobiography, you ran away from home when you were 14 in the hopes of joining Bora Minovich and his harmonica band. And I think it's a pretty brave thing to run away when you're 14. But why did you have to run away to do it?
Well, I certainly couldn't have gotten permission from my mother and father. They wouldn't let me at the age of 14 go to New York. And I wanted to get away. And I had won this mouth organ competition. I was Baltimore's mouth organ champion. I read in the paper, Lawrence Cecil Adler, this is the man you're talking to, is the champion of Baltimore, and boy, I believed it. Went right to my head, and I was stage struck. I'd seen Al Jolson, I'd seen Eddie Cantor, I'd also heard Rachmaninoff, I'd seen Otto Klemperer conduct. I wanted to do what they did, and the best way was to get on the stage somehow. Now, I had about $50 my parents didn't know about because I sold Liberty magazines. So simply, without telling them, I went down to Union Station in Baltimore, got on a train. I had met a musician named Nat Brusiloff, who'd made the great mistake of saying to me, "If you ever come to New York, kid, look me up." He didn't know, because I looked him up. And the poor man had to take care of me.
You were in vaudeville for quite a while. What was your act like, and what were some of the roles you had to take on in the act?
Well, it's a bit embarrassing, because when I first had this contract with Paramount, and I tried to do an act. Well, I didn't have an act. I didn't know how to do an act. And it was the comedian in the show. It was a traveling road show. He thought of the idea of making me a local boy. So in 44 cities, I was a local boy. I was a local boy in Philadelphia. at the local bar in Chicago and Denver. And I used to get the most applause of anyone on the bill because this is our local boy. Give him a big hand. So the other act hated my guts, but there I was, local boy, making good. One thing that does puzzle me, in those days we did not use microphones and there were stage bands. How in hell could they hear me? A mouth organ has very little projection power. And yet when I finished playing, they applauded. So do you suppose, and this is one theory, did they listen better in those days? Without the amplification, they would have to listen to hear the sound, and maybe that is the explanation.
Maybe that's it. How did you break into pop music, an American popular song, playing Rodgers and Hart, meeting the Gershwins?
Well, mind you, look who was around in those days. Yeah. Not only Rodgers and Hart, Gershwin, Jerome Kern, Harold Arlen. These people were like Schubert and Mendelssohn. They just wrote wonderful things, and you wanted to play them. Now, I was in Gus Edwards' act. It was a kiddie act. And while I was with him at the Palace, Paul Whiteman was playing at the Roxy with his own film, The King of Jazz. And I was dying to have Whiteman listen to me. So between my shows, I would go up to the Roxy and stand outside the stage door, and whoever came in or out, I'd blow the mouth organ in their face, hoping someone said, "What a talented little boy this is." Well, finally someone did. Frankie Trumbauer, the very, very famous saxophone player, took me into Whiteman's dressing room. He says, "Paul, listen to this kid." So I played Poet and Peasant. And when I finished playing it, Whiteman said, "Let me hear you play the Rhapsody in Blue." I was 15. I couldn't handle the Rhapsody in Blue. But I was a very arrogant, snotty little kid, and success has not changed me. I couldn't let him know that I didn't know Rhapsody in Blue and that it was too tough for me. So I said, "I don't like Rhapsody in Blue." So he turns to a young man I hadn't noticed before, and he said, "How do you like that, George?" And that's how I met Gershwin.
Were you friends after that?
Well, that was the end of that, because I got out fast. But however, about 3 years later, a man named Jules Glenzer, who was the vice president of Cartier, he gave me a farewell party. I was going to England for the first time. This was 1934. And at this party, there was Johnny Green, there was Harold Arlen, there was Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, George Gershwin, and with them all, I played a song of theirs. Now, I knew that sooner or later I was going to play something with George, and then our host, Jules Glenzer, said, "Larry and George are going to play the Rhapsody in Blue." Well, by now, I'd heard it so many times, it was in my head, and I've got a very good ear. If it's in my head, I can play it. So George sat at the piano, I started to play, and when we finished playing, George got up and he put his hand on my shoulder and he says, "The goddamn thing sounds as if I wrote it for you." And in my act now, I have a piano roll made by George Gershwin. That is on that record also. And I put scotch tape over the melody line. It sounds literally as if Gershwin is accompanying me. It's wonderful, and it's an eerie feeling.
You toured with Jack Benny for a long time. Did you ever play music comedy with him? We all remember his attempts at being a violin virtuoso.
Well, we would do a duet together, and Jack would hit one note like this, then me on the mouth organ. Jack. Jack. All that one note. And it was very funny. And I probably learned as much from Jack Benny as one could learn from any individual performer because, first of all, he was an encyclopedia. And he gave me advice once in two words, which is the most valuable lesson I think you could ever learn in show business. And the two words are, don't press. And boy, that is a hard lesson to learn because if you're playing for an audience that doesn't like you, the impulse is work harder, win them over. He says do just the opposite, relax, wait for them to find you.
Huh.
Oh, it takes you a long time to learn that.
Well, he had some of the best timing in all of show business.
Is nothing like Jack's timing.
And one of the subtlest performers.
Yes. And also, he was one of the most considerate of people. See, I did three overseas tours with Jack Benny during World War II, and he encouraged me to do comedy. And if I got a bigger laugh than Jack, to him, that just made the show better. There's many a comedian I know who, if you got a bigger laugh than they, you were out. You were fired. That was not Jack's way.
We should talk about your classical music playing. We've talked a little bit about vaudeville and pop. When you play with an orchestra, the orchestra has to tune to you. Is that right?
Yes. Well, the only man who ever gave me a hard time was your own ex-conductor of the Philadelphia Symphony, Eugene Ormandy. There was the Ford Symphony Hour, and Mr. Ormandy was the conductor, and I was going to be the soloist, playing the Vivaldi A Minor Concerto, the Vivaldi Violin Concerto. And I heard later he did not want to conduct for me at all, and he tried to get me canceled. But we each had a contract. Mine was as valid as his. Now, he rehearsed the orchestra and didn't let me come out until the last 10 minutes of rehearsal time, which was really awful. So I came out, and I gave my aid to the violinist, and Ormandy says, "What is this?" I said, "Well, you see, they have to tune to me. The mouth organ is the fixed reed. I cannot tune to them." He said, "This is ridiculous." And I've never talked back to a conductor. I'm a coward anyway. But I said to him, "Mr. Ormandy, I have played this work with this orchestra last year. If it embarrasses you to conduct it, I think we could do it without you."
Oh, I'm sure you got a great response to
Oh,
that.
Oh, the orchestra loved it.
Oh, dear.
Harmonica virtuoso Larry Adler speaking with Terry Gross in 1987. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Villette, Charlotte Bronte's last novel, in stores and online at bn.com. From Fox Searchlight, presenting Waitress, an uplifting comedy by Adrian Shelley about a small-town girl with big dreams, in select theaters May 11th. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In 1987, Fresh Air began its national daily broadcast. On the next Fresh Air, we celebrate our 20th anniversary with more interviews from the first year of the show. Join us for the next Fresh Air.